Pat, and William smiled. The door swung open. A plainclothes police inspector in a grey frock coat peered out at him, his silver watch chain shining in the gloom. It took William a moment to recall the man's name. "Blackwell," he said. The inspector nodded. "Mr. Shaw thought you might appreciate a hand, sir." William removed his hat in irritation, held it roughly at the brim, ran a hand through his hair, and his hand came away black from the London smut. He had said nothing to Shaw about his coming here. "Is John here, then?" he said.
"Begging your pardon, sir, the chief's occupied with the Fenians, sir."
"The Fenians?"
"With the bomb, sir, in the underground."
Blackwell blinked.
"The one went off last Friday morning at Gower Street. You didn't hear, sir?"
William ran a forefinger under the pouch of his eye, tiredly. He had heard nothing of it and did not know what to say.
"Was anyone hurt?" he asked.
"I believe so, sir."
He frowned and stepped inside, and Blackwell shut the door. There were gold and silver garlands from the holiday just past still strung from the candle sconces on the walls, and a scuffed brass trumpet standing on end in a window alcove amid fir needles.
"Then it's just you here?"
he asked. "Myself and the ghost, sir."
"I don't suppose you found a blood-stained cleaver anywhere?"
"No, sir.
An axe, maybe?"
Blackwell's eyes were heavy-lidded and bulged mildly, and William regarded them. They gave the man an astonished expression, as if he had just been swindled at cards. But then any swindler worth his weight must look just so, he knew.
"There's nothing here, sir,"
Blackwell repeated quietly.
"I'm just sort of watching the place, if you get my meaning."
William stood taking this in. He knew this meant Blackwell had been instructed to wait in case William showed up. Shaw was a good man in his way, but a jealous one and uneasy with the son of Alan Pinkerton in his city.
"Anything of interest upstairs?" he said.
"There's just the one room that looks to have been lived in, sir. The chief supposed it belonged to Miss Reckitt. The parlour?
John's been here.
This morning, sir."
Appearing embarrassed as he said it. William walked into the hall and set one hand on the balustrade, and strained to see up the stairwell in the gloom. He half expected Charlotte Reckitt's shadowy figure there, glaring accusingly down. The chandelier in the entrance behind him had not been converted to gas, and its arms loomed articulated and strange like some terrible spider. The wicks of the candles in the wall sconces had not been trimmed. His eyes followed the mouldings, the wainscoting carved in ancient Georgian fashion, all of it thickened under a layer of new dust. Plush white carpet had been tacked to the stairs, and he could see the filth from the constable's boots where they had walked. He shook his head. He started up the stairs, his bruised hand on the cool elm of the railing. The third step from the bottom groaned under his weight, and he noted this in silence. On the second floor landing, a new clock, built to look like old, had stopped at 11:37, and on either side a door opened into the back of the house. One stood open, and his gaze took in the heavy furnishings of a study. He could see a lady's sewing room overlooking the street when he turned. Drawers upended, dresses and crinolines and hat boxes tangled in heaps, papers strewn across the carpets.
"Did you find it like this?"
he called over his shoulder.
"No, sir. The detectives were rather thorough, sir."
He grunted. The floorboards creaked as he walked to the sewing room, and stood with his hat in his hand, and the damp settling in his topcoat, and he regarded the clutter. The door to the bedroom at the front of the house stood half closed, and this he opened dully upon the gloom within, and he frowned and went to the far window and drew back the curtains. A cloud of dust lifted and spun fractals in the cold light. It was a lady's bedchamber and immaculate in its tidiness. Blackwell had come up behind him and said softly,
"Sir, what's upstairs?"
"Two more bedchambers, sir. They're furnished, but we don't believe anyone is occupying them."
"They're furnished?"
"Yes, sir."
"The house must have been leased like that."
He went back downstairs and made his methodical way through the scullery and larder, and then through the kitchen, opening drawers, unscrewing jars, tapping two fingers along the walls for hidden compartments. The sink in the pantry was made of wood and lined with lead, and he ran a palm over its joinings, but felt nothing. He went outside, searched the water closet. He did not know what he was looking for, but could not shake the suspicion that the woman must have left something of interest behind. He poked his fingers through the cushions and upholstery in the parlour, and pushed aside the Christmas ornaments and the painted eggs, and wound the strands of garland from the bookcases in order to riffle the pages of each book. He made very little mess as he went, and the inspector followed behind him. "Why would a woman who lives alone go to such trouble with the decorations?" he asked. "I couldn't say, sir." He made his way back upstairs to the study, but turned up no clue there either, and at last he worked his way back to the lady's bedchamber. "I guess John thinks it's ungentlemanly to search a lady's room," he muttered. Blackwell frowned. "I believe he searched this room himself, sir." William was hot now, and he removed his top coat and laid it on the bedclothes. Two candles stood in ornate silver sticks on the mantel. Under a chaise longue in the corner, he could see shallow trays of clothes, untouched. At the dressing table he ran his finger and thumb along the antimacassar draped over the chair back, but it felt clean and soft and told him little. He pulled the chair out, sat down. His reflection in the pier glass looked, to his eye, huge, pale, sinister. He pushed aside a silver hairbrush smudged with soot, a glove stretcher, a stack of unused envelopes. "What would she need these for?" he said.
"To post her letters, sir."
He grunted.
"Who would she be writing to?"
Blackwell made a noise, and when William looked over, the inspector was plucking something from the chiffonier and frowning.
"What is it?"
"Your card, sir."
William frowned. He had left it on her doorstep on New Year's Eve to force her hand. He took it from Blackwell and pocketed it, and the inspector watched him but said nothing, and then he turned back and opened and shut the drawers of the dressing table without result. He went to the wall and got onto all fours, and traced his hand along the perimeter of the baseboards, and when he reached the ware table, he shoved it, rattling aside, with one shoulder, and a brass toilet can fell with a clang, and he kept on.
"There's nothing here," he said. "Nothing cut away, at least."
"No, sir."
He sat back on his knees, pulling at his collar.
"This is ridiculous. Let me ask you something, Inspector. Did you find any signs of a struggle?"
Blackwell cleared his throat.
"I understood she was tied up, sir."
"Maybe."
Blackwell's eyes were fixed on him.
"You're not convinced, sir?"
"Convinced," he said. "Why would she come back here? Who cut her into pieces? Who disposed of her? Why cut her hair, for God's sake?
Perhaps she thought she could get away, and was surprised at the last minute, sir."
They were both silent for a moment.
"Perhaps not everything is connected, sir. Perhaps one of the details is confusing the matter."
"Like what?"
"I couldn't say, sir. If she got out of the river alive, she'd have need of a change of clothes. Perhaps she took the opportunity to change her appearance also. Cut her hair, for instance. Perhaps she was killed later in an ordinary manner. In a street robbery, for instance."
"For God's sake, what rampsman cuts his marks up like that?"
Blackwell frowned.
"Or what if it were a personal matter? A spurned lover? That would be consistent with the violence to her body?
But not her hair. I'm trying to put it together somehow. Charlotte Rackett cut up and her hair cut off and her body left in sacks in two locations, the legs still unaccounted for. Someone was hunting her, someone I never caught sight of. She jumped from the bridge because she wanted it to look like she was dead."
"So it was a deceit, sir?"
"But not for my benefit."
"How can you be certain, sir?"
"It wouldn't make sense," he said, feeling his way towards it. He thought of his confrontation with her outside the theatre, her small wrists crushed in his grip, the sliced whites of her eyes as she stared at him in alarm. "I had nothing I could haul her in on, and she knew that. She's an old hand at this. She knew the law. She knew I was out of my jurisdiction. She was trying to escape something else. Someone else.
Her killers.
Why run to Blackfriars? It's a long way, and she ran directly for it. What was on the bridge? What was on the other side of it?
Perhaps it wasn't a thing, sir. Perhaps it was a person, an associate.
What if she was using herself as bait? What if she wasn't leading me towards the bridge, but away from something?
A That's another possibility, sir.
William looked at the man.
That is, if it wasn't accidental, of course. We pull dozens of bodies from the river in any given week, sir. But assuming the lady was murdered, you're thinking she was killed in error.
Yes, sir.
Perhaps the killer or killers did not mean for her to die. Something might have gone wrong. The disposal might have been an attempt to prolong the investigation.
I'd have thought if she was in that kind of trouble, she'd have wanted to be arrested. Blackwell nodded.
Nothing is safer than a jail, sir.
My father used to say a wall is a wall from either side, and who is to say which side is which?
Yes, sir.
Are we being kept in or kept out?
Exactly.
We were all sorry to hear about his passing, sir.
He looked at Blackwell a long moment, and then left the room and made his way upstairs. Each of the two smaller bedchambers was spare, immaculate, bedclothes tucked tightly in, porcelain bowls gleaming white under the beds. There was dust on the floor, wet boot prints traced in the dust. When he opened the armoire in the second room, he found an array of expensive gentlemen's suits and jackets folded upon the shelves, a reek of mothballs from an open box. The clothing was crisp and had not been worn in some time, and looked to William's eye 10 years out of fashion.
Those will belong to her uncle, sir,
Blackwell called from the doorway.
Martin Records in the tench, William said. I expect he'll die in there.
In Millbank, sir, yes. But it's mostly a military prison now, sir. I understand this talk of his being transferred south to the prison hulks when it closes next year.
William frowned in distraction.
I didn't know it was closing.
A lack of funds, sir.
William crossed to the window and pressed a hand against the glass, and the glass was cold.
I'll want to talk to him, he said. He was a priest once, wasn't he?
So I'm told, sir.
But William's eyes were drifting now around the room, and he did not say anything more, and after a moment he walked slowly to one corner. A large birdcage was suspended there, covered by a white sheet, and he pulled the sheet gently back. The cage was empty. What happened to the larks? He asked. Blackwell was stooped over a birchwood washstand, and he paused now and straightened.
Larks, sir?
William opened the little door and pinched a tiny grey feather from the tangle of grass.
Why would anyone take her birds?
Perhaps they saw something they shouldn't have, sir.
The birds?
I don't know, sir.
Blackwell paused.
Either way, it shouldn't matter.
Why not?
They weren't canaries.
William stared at him.
Are you making a joke, Inspector?
Shall I put out a description of the jailbirds, sir?
You can stop any time, Inspector.
It could be someone just took them on a lark, sir.
Blackwell, stop.
Yes, sir,
he said, and turned back and pushed aside a brass pot in the cupboard to feel for hidden catches. That night he tried to sleep, but could not. The bed was warm from the swaddled hot brick laid in by the hotel maid, and he got up resignedly into the freezing room. He wrapped himself in a blanket and retrieved Ben Porter's papers from the cigar drawer for something to do. He was thinking still of Charlotte Reckitt's body, and waiting for his mind to clear. He sat in a wingback chair near the fireplace and rested his elbows on the bullets, and then, crossing his legs, he sifted the papers in his lap. The lamps cast a weak, sulphurous light. A man with strong vision could just read by, and he knew if he did not sleep soon, he would be no good to anyone. He rubbed his eyes. Ben's reports went back some 14 years. William read and reread what he could, feeling an irritation growing in him. He had believed Ben Porter to be an occasional informer and operative for his father in cases of criminals fleeing to England. But this did not appear to be true. Porter had worked almost exclusively as a detective for his father for more than 20 years, and during the last decade of his life worked solely on the peculiar obsession of Edward Shade. According to the papers, Porter had begun haunting London's East End in 1869, when a description of an American thief had surfaced. He had taken work as a deal porter in a riverfront warehouse along the Surrey docks in order to observe the area, but had found no further leads. Then a rumor had emerged that an American, by the name of Donald Rolson, had taken rooms in Piccadilly, and Porter had taken up work as a postal delivery clerk in order to acquaint himself with the neighborhood. Rolson was rumoured to have set up a gambling den for gentlemen in the West End, but Porter could not be certain, and no sooner had such a rumour spread than the operation closed and vanished. What emerged gradually in Porter's reports, and in William's father's replies, was not a sense of the elusive shade, so much as a shadow, an echo of a man who may have never existed. 6 feet in height, with long arms, and a lean, athletic build, or perhaps 5.5 feet, with a portly build, and the short arms of a shopkeeper. A man with no facial hair, and who kept his brown hair shorn close to the scalp. Or perhaps a bald man, with carefully groomed whiskers. A man with cat-like grey eyes and a quiet grimness about him. Or perhaps a jovial and clumsy companion, who was drawn to the company of his betters. A man with no fear of God or law or country. Or a man terrified of himself as well as all else. He might have been Edward Shade, or Donald Rolson, or William Peters Mackenzie. He might have been married, or not. One of the last letters from William's father suggested two Edward Shades might be working together, and that Porter ought to keep an eye out for both of them. William thought of his father with his powerful Cooper's shoulders, his Scottish rages and righteous indignation. He remembered the sharp bite of the man's belt against the backs of his boyhood thighs. He looked again at the handwriting in the margins, and at his father's wild surmising, and he shook his head. Ridiculous. He pushed aside the papers in disgust. 6. 82 Half Moon Street loomed up out of the fog. Fool rolled a cold thumb over the head of his walking stick. He felt what he always felt, seeing it, seeing the small brass-plated sign he had screwed into the railing himself all those years ago. Fool's Rare Goods Emporium, Imports and Exports, by appointment only. They had come by hired coach direct from the choking fumes of Gower Street Station, and he had got out exhausted. He stooped now in the walk, with one hand on the railing, and a yellow mist biting at his ankles, flowing past. He could see the front door standing open, Flood fumbling in the gloom. A slow hammering of iron on iron started up from the roof across the street, and though he turned and peered across, he could not see the workmen. The windows in the terraced house opposite were dark, and the drapes closed, and the brown stucco depressing in the chill. He turned away. There were smuts and blacks and flakes of soot adrift in the air around him like an evil snow. He could hear the clop and rattle of a hansom passing, disappearing down the cobblestones. A phantom, blurred in the mist, banged a trunk step by step up the white stones towards him. That was Molly. Then Flood brushed past, descended again into the fog where the coach was still unloading. All of it muffled, dreamlike, eerie. The shabby main floor of the house was filled to overflowing with artifacts and objects shipped in from the corners of the empire. Ancient Asian vases, looking glasses from Australia, minerals and crystals from the mountains in East Africa, Indian headdresses, a chest of rusted sextants recovered from a wreck in a reef in the Caribbean. Fool loved the shadowy labyrinth of his emporium. He had few customers. His prices were not listed. 4 years earlier, he had leased this big house in its fashionable district just off Piccadilly and across from Green Park without having seen it, and had paid the 6 months in advance through a land agent operating out of Chelsea. He had insisted on a residence expensively furnished, with tableware provided, with Turkish carpets and a lavatory pan on each floor, and horsehair bedding covered in squares of Holland under the feather mattresses. He had engaged a housekeeper and her daughter on the recommendation of an associate who had praised them for their discretion and had offered a generous salary. The previous occupants had broken their lease in a hurry when their second child was born dead, and there was a sheen of illness to the house even now. Fool had made his way through the damp rooms, following at his housekeeper's heels, as she told him what she had gleaned of the place. She regarded that second child's stillbirth as a moral failure, rather than a physical one, and pursed her lips whenever the matter was broached. Her name was Sykes, and her wraith-like daughter's Hetty, and she was a strong, wide-hipped, hempen widow of 40. She would gnarl one hand into a fist whenever he called her to him, and it was no delicate fist, but strained white with knuckle and bone. He liked the hardness he saw in her, the austerity.
Molly tolerated her as a cat would have done, and that was good enough for Fool. Mrs. Sykes wore an apron stained with grease and blacking when she was not serving, and a grim-fringed bonnet that held her grey hair in place, but there was in her eyes such an angry, green intelligence that he wondered if she had talents yet untested.
"Mr. Fool, sir,"
she said to him now, "it's a fine big house to run, with only my Hetty and hardly a penny to the purse. How long do you mean to stay this time?" She was standing at the foot of the stairs, wiping her hands on her apron, among the foyer collection of Chinese vases on their shelves. Fool smiled at her.
"It's good to see you, too."
Flood appeared in the doorway and stamped his boots, and Fool put out a hand.
"Mrs. Sykes, this," he said, "is my dear friend Mr. Flood. He's returning to us after a long while abroad. I thought he could take the East Room, across from Molly."
"Ma'am?" Flood said shyly, doffing his hat.
"Japheth Flood, in the mighty flesh, is it?"
She gave the giant a strange, sly look, as if assessing a shank of meat.
"Oh, I heard stories about you, sir. I'll see to the room, Mr. Fool, but he'll be wanting to change those boots before he goes on up."
All three studied Flood's boots a moment in silence. It might have been the bad lighting, or the recent exertions, but it looked to Fool as if the big man's face under his beard had reddened. Fool cleared his throat.
"Japheth, you let Mrs. Sykes know what you need, and she'll see that you get it. She's been a treasure to me these past years."
He was looking at his old housekeeper fondly, and wondering how much to tell her, and then he could not help himself, and he said, smiling,
"We may have another yet." "Would that be a lady, sir?"
"Why do you say that?" She winked, raised a finger to her lips.
"Now, where's the wee one? Is she hungry?"
"Always," Fool laughed. "I'd look for her in the larder." Those first days back, overwhelmed, there was much to be done in the airing of rooms and establishing of meetings, and in the planning and weighing and diagramming of securities. Mrs. Sykes insisted on cataloguing each article, or furnishing, sold in his absence, room by room, in a ledger, with Fool accompanying to sign off on each.
"If just to keep the staff honest-like,"
she explained, while she grumbled at the cost of outfitting a household with coal in the winter months.
"If you had have only returned to us in the summer, Mr. Fool,"
she'd scowl,
"I'd save you 6 shillings on the ton right easy. Them creditors of ours ain't like to stretch much further."
He liked that use of ours, felt a gratitude well up in him to hear it. The basement buzzer rang constantly with rag-and-bone men, crockery girls, peddlers selling rabbits and pecks of peas and roots and herbs tied up by their ankles and dried. There were watercress girls in the mornings and butcher's apprentices in the afternoons and cockles and mussel men hollering in the streets outside before tea. Fool would work late into the night in a study behind the glass display cases, with trunk lids standing open and the long mahogany desk shining in the gaslight, and Hetty, in her pallid thinness, would come and go with a tray of dishes and vessels of hot water for washing. Fool would smile at her and gesture to the corner, where Flood was penciling his accounts, where Molly was cleaning a satchel of picks and drivers, and he would watch the girl blush shyly to see them. On the second morning, Fool came down to find Flood with his shirt sleeves rolled back, scrubbing the fender irons in the drawing-room fireplace to a high shine. He clutched in one big hand a strip of dry leather, and he paused and leaned back on his heels and ran the back of the hand across his face. Beside him sat a small twist jar of black lead paste.
"Good God, what is that smell?"
Fool said in a low voice.
"Has Mrs. Sykes put you to work already, then?"
"She says you can't afford a proper lead."
Flood smiled wearily.
"Oh, I don't mind it. Easier work than breaking rocks."
"Where is she?"
Flood shrugged. In the basement kitchen he found his housekeeper with her skirts tied up between her legs, hurtling pail after pail of cold water and carbolic across the linoleum, the silver tongue of the water hanging in the air a long instant as it fell, then the crash and overspill and washback and sweep through with the broom, as she scowled and stomped up and down, and guided the water through the open door and down the rivering basement step into the alley. A disk of sulphur smoldered on the range.
"Mrs. Sykes,"
he called from the doorway. "Mrs. Sykes!" She glanced up, startled, gave him a look like murder. The carving table had been dragged up against the cupboard and the two Windsor chairs upended on it, and in the middle of the floor, a bedframe had been dismantled and set to steep in a stub of scummy water. Fool's gaze took all this in, and the brown floral wallpaper along the low ceiling, where the big beam ran buckling and warping the length of the house, and he looked at the meat screen, and the iron range between the stairs, and the grimy little window, and he shook his head.
"It's the last girl what was here, sir," Mrs. Sykes said. "She was asleepin' in the kitchen and dirty as bugs herself."
Fool walked through the water, picked up the tin of Keating's powder from the table, turned it in his fingers.
"She's been gone weeks," he said. "Is it bedbugs?"
"Aye, but don't you worry yourself, sir. There ain't no bug alive what can keep out of my sight."
"Get rid of the bedding," he said abruptly. "The frame, the mattress, all of it. Go out and find an iron one. It's the old wood, Mrs. Sykes. It'll never get clean."
She stood in the wet, with one hand on the grey broom.
"No sense in that, sir. It's a perfectly good bed. I can manage."
"I don't doubt you can. Talk to Mr. Flood. He'll give you the coins. And Mrs. Sykes?"
"Sir?"
"Your diligence has been noted." She reddened and dipped, and put a hand to her mussed hair. Through all this, something was building in him, a kind of light-headedness that he recognized from the evening before a job, a tingling ache in his fingertips and his teeth, which he used to feel in his childhood when the thunderclouds broke over Boston. In everything he did, unpacking his papers, sorting through his files, adjusting his suits and collars in their boxes, ringing for Hetty to bring hot water from the boiler and fresh towels for a shave, in everything he did, he thought of Charlotte, as if a hook lay scalloped in his skull. Had it been 10 years, truly? Was he so different a man now? She would be older, yes. Wearier, yes. Harder, perhaps, as he himself had come to be. Of the women he had known in his life, none could have tempted him to put aside his work, to give up the trade, to turn himself into a man of the sunlit street and the honest hour. None but one. And she would not have asked it. He remembered her in that terraced café above the sea in Port Elizabeth. She had told him of the discovery, by French adventurers, of hundreds of clay tablets in a cave in the Near East, and it had seemed to her important, as if she were speaking of something under the words themselves, beneath the language. He remembered the silver light off the waves, remembered lifting a palm to one side to see her face through the glare. The tablets had been written in a language no one had seen before, and many had believed them works of poetry, records of history, a chronicle of kings. The wind had lifted the folds of her white dress, the seabirds aloft in the currents of air. When they were deciphered, she told him, it was discovered they were business transactions, shipping records, inventories. "There is in every life a shadow of the possible," she said to him, "the almost and the might have been. There are the histories that never were. We imagine we are keeping our accounts, but what we are really saying is, I was here. I was real. This did happen once. It happened." All this he held to himself and did not speak of, as those first days clocked down. The house went on in its domestic strangeness. He was standing with Mrs. Sykes at the bend in the basement stairs, going through the list of pantry stock, when a low, throaty singing filled the hall. Both paused, and then Molly sashayed into view, a cinder bucket looped over one wrist, shirt tails untucked, her hands on her hips, and a sultry swagger to her backside. She strutted on past, unseeing. The drawing-room door opened, closed. Mrs. Sykes cleared her throat.
"Right queer one, that,"
she muttered, twisting and untwisting the washrag in her fists. At noon on the third day, a delivery man rang the tradesman's bell at the basement door and was ushered by Mrs. Sykes in through the kitchen and up the back stairs to the emporium. Molly took the small crate from him, but she could not hold it, and Flood lurched forward and caught it and helped her set it down between the shelves. A scowl crossed her face, and she did not thank him. All this Fool watched without moving from behind his desk.
the warped floorboards creaking where Flood walked. There was a low fire burning, but it gave off little heat. The crate held a sampling of small ammonite fossils still embedded in limestone blocks, shipped privately from Geneva, and under the straw packing in a false bottom were a variety of sapphire and ruby pendants, taken from a Swiss jeweler. Molly turned each piece in the light of the window, looking unimpressed, then handed it along to Flood, who passed it to Fool. Molly said she hoped their partners on the continent had a sharper eye than this. Fool was quiet for a moment, and then he told her to have the pendants translated at a cut of 70% by their regular tailor, and to handle the transaction herself.
"You mean to let the kid do it?" Flood said abruptly. "Does she know the margins?"
Fool blinked. "The margins?" Molly laughed a sharp laugh and shook her head and wiped an exaggerated tear.
"Margins," she said. "No one uses margins no more. We take a cut off the percentages in both directions, jappy old boy." "Margins," she grinned, shaking her head.
"There have been some changes since you were last outside," Fool said. "You'll catch on."
"Aye."
"Margins," Molly chuckled.
"Molly, what's got into you?" The girl stopped smiling, looked at him. She put the last fossil back into the crate, chewed at a nail, leaned over, spat some half-moon into the fireplace.
"Nothing,"
she said. Fool grunted, tugging at his whiskers.
"Japheth,"
he said, "I'd like you to go over."
"Nothing's got into me," Molly interrupted loudly, "except Charlotte Bloody Wreckit and her weepy bloody letter."
She pulled out a creased envelope and withdrew Charlotte's letter, glaring the while at Fool.
"I won't ask you where you got that," he said.
"My dear Fool,"
she began in a quavering high voice. She squinched up one eye like a bat.
"Molly?"
"I write you, knowing how much time has passed between us."
He kicked back his chair and stood, his fingertips poised on the desk.
"That's enough, Molly.
And just what's your regard for me must have suffered these past 10 years?
"Oh, kid," Flood said in his low rumble, "that ain't right."
And he stretched a long arm over her shoulder and slid the paper from her fingers.
"Where did you learn letters like that anyway?" he asked. "You read like a preacher."
"She's a quick study," Fool said tightly. Molly flushed.
"Did you visit her, Mr. Utterson, yet? You want to tell us the job?"
Flood turned from the girl, studied Fool.
"Utterson? The attorney?"
Molly said.
"You ain't still getting reports from him now, Mr. Adam?"
"For God's sake,"
Fool said. "It's no part of my business, mine alone."
Flood paid this no mind and instead rubbed at his beard with an open hand and turned to Molly.
"Gabriel Utterson used to let Mr. Adam know what Charlotte was up to," he said. "Was a time we used to see him regular-like. That were years ago now."
"Aho!"
Molly cried. She got angrily to her feet.
"A right regular romance, innit? How long was you planning to keep this from me?"
Flood started to laugh.
"Kid sounds jealous."
"I ain't jealous."
"I'm to go see him this afternoon," Fool said. He held up a hand. "Sit down, please. There's no secret to it. Charlotte left instructions with Gabriel about the job. I'm to go through the instructions, and if I'm still interested, I'm to call on her in Hampstead." Molly sucked in her lips, her nostrils flaring.
"Ain't it lucky I got nothing planned for today?"
"I'm to go alone, Molly."
"Why?"
She raised her voice.
"You afraid your plonk-eyed Patty going to be there?"
Fool looked past her at his old friend, apologetic.
"The letter's clear on it, Japheth. I'm going to his Gaunt Street address unaccompanied. I'll tell you this evening what I glean from him."
"Aye, you will."
Flood gestured at the letter on Fool's desk.
"But it don't feel right. Is that the whole letter written, like what Molly just was reading? As if there weren't nothing much between you and Charlotte needing to be aired?"
"Oh, it gets worse," Molly called out. "It gets near to disgusting."
"The kid ain't often right," Flood grimaced, "but this might be one of them exceptions. Gabriel weren't never one of us. He weren't never to be trusted. But he was never dangerous. Bugger that. Flood scooped at his beard. Don't you go alone, Mr. Adam.
He ain't going to,
Molly called.
Gabriel's queerer than he was.
Fool frowned.
He's cautious. That's what Charlotte's instructions mean. If I go in company, he might refuse to meet, even if the company is Molly. And if they wish me harm, Fool began, then trailed off.
He stared out the window. A cart clattered somewhere in the alley behind the garden wall, and something passed like a darkness through the long grass there. At last he nodded. He could see the sense in Flood's concern, and although he did not say it, he knew he himself did not wholly trust the letter either. Molly reached out and put a hand on his arm, and Fool met her eye.
All right,
he said, giving way.
All right.
He looked sternly at Molly. But you keep your thoughts to yourself and do exactly as I say.
Understood.
Molly smiled a sly smile.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yes.
I mean it, Molly.
To yourself.
She smiled and smiled. She had already scooped up a handful of straw packing from the crate and stuffed it now tidily back into place with a wink, and she was humming to herself as she left the room. After she was gone, Flood got up and shut the door, and he stood a moment listening, and then he sat back down.
I ain't going to ask you where the prophet is in all this, he said in a low voice.
Fool nodded.
I appreciate that.
I know you and Charlotte have your history.
Well,
and I figure loyalty like that is a quality I ought to encourage in them what I work with. But I guess I hope there's some angle in it I don't see as yet.
He glanced up.
You ain't forgetting what her uncle was like.
Martin has nothing to do with this.
Martin Rickard is a bad slice, he is. Even the church didn't want him.
He was never a priest.
He were defrocked.
He wasn't.
He was ordained, but he never practiced.
He was never a priest, Japheth.
He had a different calling. Bugger that. You know what he done, Mr. Adam.
All he did was walk away from me.
And leave you to die.
Fool nodded and said nothing. And then he said,
he also nursed me back to life.
He could have just taken what he wanted and gone.
He didn't.
Aye. And he could have cut your throat, too. There ain't no shortage of ways to do a jack-in. Just because he took one way over another doesn't make it less of a betrayal.
It does to me, Fool said quietly. Besides, Charlotte is not her uncle.
You're wrong on that,
Flood said. He was looking at him strangely, and then he cracked his big knuckles and folded his arms.
There's something else, he said. I don't reckon there's any right way to say this. Last night I paid a old hello to our Jill in Bermondsey, for old time's sake like.
I know.
Flood blinked.
You keeping me tab open?
I wanted to make sure you kept out of trouble. How is she?
Flood shook his shaggy head.
She says if we waiting for Charlotte Rickard, we like to be waiting a long time. That business you mentioned from the letter, about her being hunted by a detective? It's bloody Pinkerton what's been hunting her.
Fool raised his face.
Pinkerton?
Aye.
Pinkerton's dead, Japheth. Not that one. The son. William.
Fool felt something in his stomach give way. He rubbed his face, stared out at the garden, the mists scrolling through the bamboo thicket, the bare apple tree against the stone wall. When he turned back, Flood was massaging one huge shoulder as if to ease some hurt from it.
Seems he were tracing some knack Charlotte once worked with,
Flood said. Someone out of the swell mob.
And something's afoot still. The beaks is all abuzz with it. Pinkerton's got a hand in it up to his bloody elbow.
A hand in what?
Flood gave him a long, level look.
She ain't said the name. But we both know who.
Edward Shade.
Flood nodded.
Just like his da.
Fool got up and crossed back to the window and clasped his hands behind him and stood like that a moment as the fog curled past.
You want I should do something?
Fool was quiet.
No,
he said finally.
Yes.
Let's keep an eye on Mr. William Pinkerton. Have one of our snipes trail him and report back. Let me know if he crosses into Bermondsey again.
Fool stared at the fog and brooded and stared.
"Do you believe in consequences, Japheth?"
he asked. "Never," the giant said. "I live my life by it."
"You frighten me sometimes."
"Only sometimes." Fool turned. Flood was grinning at him in the gloom. Late that afternoon, he and Molly went to call on Utterson at his home. They made their way down to Piccadilly and hailed a hansom heading east, and Fool directed the driver to take them to Gaunt Street in Bishopsgate. Molly gave him a look, and they rode a while in silence, through the fog-bound streets, and then she turned to him and wiped a spot of soot from her face and asked him outright,
"Bishopsgate? What kind of lawyer lives in bloody Bishopsgate?"
He gave her a quiet, secretive smile, and reached across, picked at the lining of her breeches, where a thread had come loose.
"You'll want Mrs. Sykes to give that a look," he said.
She scowled and folded her arms and glared out at the streets. They came to a halt outside a tall terraced house. It had long since fallen into ruin. The unpainted railings, the smeared brickwork, the ancient wooden door knocker, all cracked and gone green with long use in the foul air. Fool knocked twice, then stepped back and brushed at his sleeves.
"He don't live here all on his own, now,"
Molly said, grimacing.
"Waste of bloody space."
"It's his sister's house. He lives with her." She laughed sharply.
"Keep your tongue,"
Fool muttered. "There's nothing amusing in it. She was a memsahib in the Raj before she came back to England, and she's been in the flash longer than you've had teeth to pick at. Anything you say to her, she will not forget. Oh, I can handle myself." He gave Molly a long look.
"She'd as soon cut your throat as offer you a drink," he said, "and that would be a kindness from her."
Just then the door groaned, shivering back on its hinges, and he straightened. A huge Sikh in blue livery and a gold headdress, and wearing slippers of an oriental cast, nodded without speaking, and Fool bowed gravely to him and introduced himself. The footman stepped aside, his white gloves extended, palms up. Fool removed his top hat, his cane, his gloves, and then the footman stepped behind him, and the floor creaked under his weight, and Fool felt himself being delicately disarticulated from his frock coat.
"Is Mr. Utterson at home?"
Fool asked. The footman was gesturing to Molly and did not answer, but when Fool glanced up, he saw a woman had materialized out of the darkness of the hall.
"Miss Utterson," he said, and bowed.
"Kishub is a mute, Mr. Fuel," she said. "He cannot help you."
"Fuel," it sounded like. "You are not alone, sir," she added, her voice, so like silk rustling.
He had not heard it in years. She wore a thick mascara of ash and elderberry juice, and had lined her eyes in kohl, like some eastern concubine, and her long, pale throat and sharp collarbone glowed whitely in the afternoon gloom. After a moment, she stepped fluidly aside and half turned from him, and he understood he was to follow. The footman preceded them down the long hall, drew aside the drapery at a doorway, and the lady went past and through into the smoking room beyond. They had been lovers long years ago, and friends after that, and he thought her feline and beautiful still. The hard years had come out in her face near the eyes, but the effect was to deepen and sadden a mystery latent in her, and it made her the more desirable. She had travelled to the Raj in search of a husband in the spring of 1857, and returned 15 years later, alone, and to Fool's knowledge was unmarried still. She had told Fool of that first journey across Egypt by land in terror of bandits, and of sleeping outside on the deck of the P&O steamship under the Southern Cross. Flying fish in their shivering arcs like fairies of the sea, the wake of phosphorus in becalmed waters. India, she said, had assailed her eyes in a roar of reds and pinks and oranges, yellow saris cut with blue, the mingled spices of ginger, cloves, turmeric, the smoke of sandalwood and burning cow dung, the clang of bells and bullock carts squeaking in the streets. All this she had told him while running her cool hands over the skin of his back, one afternoon, years ago, and he had listened with his eyes half closed and thought of his own Africa. She would be 52 now. At the door, he paused. Long gaslit sconces burned low on the walls. His eyes passed over the indoor lily pond,
its scarlet cushions arranged in a circle around the water, the soaring ceiling lost in shadow. On the walls were squares of a gold damask wallpaper, squares of a red and green trellis pattern of birds, a painted Japanese screen in one corner, a tall hookah in a black Japanese varnish in another, its pipes cabling snake-like at its base. Fool could hear the muffled sounds of the street through the white and blue drapery, drawn and glowing with the light of the outer world. "What is all this?" Fool said with a smile. Molly had come through with him and stopped half-concealed in the doorway curtain, and he set a hand on the child's shoulder to keep her back.
"You don't like it?"
"It's a wonder." A faint curl of her lips, the eyelids closing a moment as her face registered the compliment.
"You'll have a drink," she murmured.
It was not a question. Her servant had receded into the darkness. She crossed to a sideboard and unstoppered a crystal decanter and poured out two cut glass goblets of sherry, and then looked across at Molly in the doorway as if considering. Then she moved away, sat down on a cushion with her legs folded to one side of her, smoothed her skirts around her.
"It has been a long time," she said.
He smiled. "Not so long."
"You were away on pleasure?"
"Business."
"Is there a difference?"
She crossed her long legs at the ankle with a slow, cat-like grace that he remembered from years past.
"My brother is not at home. Why don't you tell me the details, and I shall convey them to him? What is to be discussed?"
"Charlotte Reckitt." She waited. She left instructions with Gabriel for me.
"Charlotte Reckitt," she said,
touching a jeweled finger to her lips.
"No, I don't believe I know her. Is she a whore's
rose?" he interrupted. Molly snickered in the gloom behind them.
"Hmm?
Must we do this?" When she said nothing, he furrowed his brow and said, "Charlotte's the best grifter still in the blush in London. Her uncle was taken to Millbank in 74.
"Ah, yes, the famous Martin Reckitt."
"You remember Martin?"
"Of course. Gabriel is still representing him."
Fool paused, studied her cautiously.
"I had understood Gabriel was changing the kind of clients he took on."
"He has kept a few of his more valued clients."
Fool leaned forward. "Does Martin still have a hand in?"
"Martin Reckitt is a model inmate at Millbank, Mr. Fool. His good behavior is a testament to his reformed ways, and nothing goes in or out of Millbank except through the proper channels."
"Does he still have a hand in, Rose?" She folded her jeweled fingers, her eyes hidden in the low light.
"I do remember he had a niece," she said. "Yes, now I remember."
Her lashes flicked languidly over Molly standing in her boy's suit beside the tapestry at the door.
"A beauty,"
she said softly, patting the cushion next to her in invitation. "The boy's all right where he is," he said.
"The boy?"
He could hear Molly breathing in the gloom, but he did not turn to look at her, and she did not step forward.
"In the Raj,"
Rose murmured,
"we learned to be more flexible with our appetites. One must embrace the unexpected, no?"
But she was studying Molly with a cold, flat stare, as if weighing a shank of meat, and Fool felt a sudden danger. He cleared his throat.
"Rose." "Yes,"
she said at last, lowering her gaze.
"Go on."
"Charlotte's been in touch. Gabriel has instructions for me. Something to do with the project she's been organizing. I was to meet him here today. Is he not here?"
"You were to come alone."
Fool frowned.
"This is rather like in Madrid, I think."
"It's nothing like Madrid."
"You do have some difficulty in following directions, Mr. Fuel."
But she said it gently, and Fool sipped his sherry, smiled a sad smile.
"That's not what I remember about Madrid," he said.
"You still have a concern with her as well, I think. With this niece?"
Fool felt his smile stiffen, and he glanced away. "I haven't spoken to Charlotte in years," he said quietly. "But yes, there is that. Of course. There's always been that." She leaned forward now and lowered her voice.
"My sweet, sweet man,"
she murmured,
I've been asking myself, what is this path my dear Mr. Fuel walks? He doesn't write. He doesn't visit. What a surprise to find him in London again.
We've all kept ourselves busy, Rose. I think of you fondly. She smiled a smoky smile. And your brother? He is well, I hope.
My brother won't meet with you,
she murmured.
Since the Asperton affair, he prefers to keep his distance from the Flash.
But Charlotte's letter was clear.
Your Charlotte has become a rather dangerous associate.
Fool wet his lips. What do you mean?
You would be wise to keep your distance, Mr. Fuel.
You're talking about Pinkerton. She held his eye.
Mr. Pinkerton has been in London for weeks looking for your Miss Reckitt, yes. And not on agency business, some personal matter. When we last saw her, she said, he had been asking about an old associate, someone his father had pursued. She did not say who. She was frightened. And then she disappeared.
Disappeared?
Last Thursday, yes. You must have heard of this. We understand the Yard is expecting her body to wash up downriver, but you and I both know what that is worth. Gabriel has made his own inquiries. The only thing he is certain of is that she did not leave town, at least not by the usual routes.
Miss Utterson saw the effect her words were having, and she fell silent, and then, after a moment, she reached behind her and brought out a small, scented envelope of rice paper.
Miss Reckitt asked us to convey this to you.
The envelope was empty. There was an address for Hampstead written on the front.
This is hers.
Fool asked in a rough voice. Miss Utterson frowned in the half-light, then let it fade in a long, slow, sphinx-like smoothing of her features.
I would not recommend you go to her. I understand the police have occupied the residence.
So the job's off, he said slowly, and Gabriel's washed his hands of it. What does he believe? Does he believe she's still in the city? What do you believe? Miss Utterson regarded him.
You remember, Mr. Fuel, how it was between us, what happened in Spain. It seems what occurred was no accident. I have a gift.
Rose, he said impatiently. He shook his head, stopped. Remembering how it had been, the jobs they had worked together in the Flash. She had dreamed during their last job in Madrid the precise events of the next day's heist, including the ambush by the police and the shooting of their cracksman. He had laughed it off the morning before the heist. That night, hiding in their hotel room, he had not been able to look at her. She was quiet, as if considering something. Then she met his gaze with her smoky eyes.
The spirits manifest in me, she said.
The spirits?
The lost ones. Yes.
You're a medium.
I am a receptive. It is not the same.
He had heard rumours of Gabriel's interest in this realm, but he had not expected this. He had seen advertisements for seances in the newspapers in the years following the Civil War, but had never given it much credence. It seemed too close to a grift. He looked at her and then around him at the weird exotic furnishings, and then he looked at her again. The shadows seemed to lengthen. He looked at his drink, then set it with a click at his feet. He was thinking about Charlotte and Hampstead.
There is much confusion on the other side, she said. I hope it is not true. But the name Charlotte has been spoken.
For God's sake! She tilted her face, long earrings clicking.
Rose,
he said. His voice had an edge to it. If this is some kind of glim's pluck. He stared at her very hard. You know, I don't take well to being rolled. She set a cool hand on his arm. She said,
In Calcutta, our cook used to say, when a voice speaks that has been long silent, it is natural to listen. That voice, it is speaking to you now.
I'm sure I don't know what you mean.
You do, she said. The spirits communicate through me, not to me. Gabriel holds the circle together, and I am not told what is said until later. A receptive is asleep when it comes over her. So what I tell you about Miss Reckitt, it's the truth.
You're telling me the dead are talking about her.
Death is only a beginning, she said, meeting his gaze.
He glanced across at Molly where she stood listening. There was in her face a stubborn dislike that he knew masked fear. She was twisting one wrist tightly in a hand.
You'll let Gabriel know that I stopped in, he said, getting to his feet. Thank you for the sherry.
As they were leaving, Miss Utterson reached down and gripped Molly's chin in one bejeweled claw, and twisted her face up so that she might stare into it. Fool could see the fury in the child's eyes.
I know what is in your heart, little one, she said to the child. I was damaged also as a girl. The world is not kind to the innocent.
Molly's eyes flickered. Miss Utterson released her, smoothed her hair. The huge Sikh stood behind them, holding the door, eyes forward.
Mr. Fuel, she said, you will come again, I hope.
He pressed the inside of her wrist to his lips in reply. Molly might have ceased to exist, but then the aging Memsahib murmured,
Oh, do not give your heart to him, little one.
She was holding her cool palm to Fool's cheek as she said this, and she did not take her eyes from his. Outside in the street he felt strange, broken with light, as if shining with some secret dread. It seemed all who passed in the busy crowds must turn from him and shade their eyes. Molly put a small hand on his wrist and said,
Oh, Adam, just because the beaks is looking for her in the soup ain't the same as her being in it.
He did not know what to reply. It was a kindness for her to speak so, and he found himself overwhelmed by the gesture. He left her at a cab stand in Bishopsgate with a full purse, and he adjusted his gloves and stared into the fog, and then set out for Finsbury Circus. It had begun to rain a faint, brackish rain, more a mist than a rain, and Fool walked through it without regard, as the water balled and spattered down the gabardine. At a flower seller's stall he purchased a clutch of blue irises, as if to disprove Rose Utterson's words, then changed his mind and started to throw them into the street, and then changed his mind again. The rain deepened. A hansom took him languidly through the wet and the chill, and he watched the horse's wet haunches slide luminous in the sheeted water. He felt the shake of water from the reins passing through their guides, heard the crunch and splash of wheels on the stone streets. He checked and double-checked the address in Hampstead he had been given. Soon they had left the extinguishing city and were passing uphill through the half-built terraces, and the low sky leaned down over the weeded lots and the muck, and then they were turning up a lane of expensive new brick houses, and the cab drew to a halt. Fool studied the high, terraced house. Then he got down. His heart was hammering inside him. He stood feeling the rain drip from the brim of his top hat, and thought of how she would look as she opened the door, the smell of her hair in the wet. The chill fist of petals shone in the light. The first hint something was not right occurred to him when he saw the whited doorstep, the scuffed boot prints there. When he knocked, he listened but could hear no answer within. No lights were burning in the windows. He shifted the flowers from hand to hand. After a moment, the door rattled and shuddered through its unlocking. It opened. A stranger in a grey frock coat stood before him, regarding the bouquet in the gloom, his protuberant eyes heavy-lidded and sad. The man was standing with the stiffness of a plain-clothes police inspector, and then something sharpened in Fool, some pre-shaping of his lots, like the outline of covered furniture in a shuttered house.
"Is Miss Reckitt not at home?"
he asked. The inspector cleared his throat, peered past him at the hansom waiting in the street beyond, settled his gaze on the irises in Fool's fist.
"I regret to inform you, sir," he began, and like that, a door slammed shut in Fool's heart.
All the Mornings in the World. 1874. South Africa. They had met on the rooftop balcony of a sunlit hotel in Port Elizabeth, and they had disliked each other at once. He thought her sly, watchful. She thought him cold. He took her hand in his, and it felt hot, dry, scaled. She winced at his grip.
She seemed to him tiny, pale, a theatrical creature, insincere in her gestures, and he seemed to her abrupt in the brutal manner of American men. A guest was tinking his timid way across the pianoforte and the bar inside, and the sound drifted through the slatted windows to where the three of them sat, as if it carried through water. He crossed his legs. She smoothed her dress. The third with them was the elder by 28 years, and he turned the ice in his glass and smiled, smiled, smiled under the latticed shade of the wickerwork. There were white caps cresting and unfurling in the stark below, seabirds wheeling in the spray. Adam Fool would remember the sunlight on that afternoon, the white sand beach stretching away to the east like the curve of an eyelid. She said her name was Charlotte. She had been an actress on the London stage. He said he did not care for the theatre, not as a boy, not as a man. Had he been wiser in matters of the flesh, he might have seen the signs, and feared the turn his life would take. But what was happening in him had not happened before, and so he could not have known to call it by its name. He was still young. He had come alone through the Cape, posing as an ostrich feather investor by the name of Bentley, then journeyed east to Port Elizabeth, where he checked into the finest hotel and waited for his accomplice to arrive. It was a seaport hotel, frenzied with the wealth of the diamond trade, set down at the very bottom of the world. And out of this hot, crowded stew, he rode for days on end, returning from the interior with large purchases of feathers, which he then crated and shipped to a rented storehouse in southeast London. That was the peak of the feather boom, and no lady's hat was complete without its long, curved ostrich sheen. He opened an office near the docks and hired a clerk and posted advertisements in the local papers, seeking inland agents for his business. He was careful to protest loudly the expense of shipping in the lounge of the hotel, in the restaurants overlooking the offshore islands, in the post office itself. He stood several patrons their drinks and spoke of his business partner in friendly terms. He laughed, played whist, smoked late, ate alone, poring over his ledgers in the manner of any sober businessman, and, in short, made himself liked. Through all this, it was the light that astonished him. The light he expected to remember. The hard flat bang of it, like a sheet of tin as it shuddered and recoiled in the roadbeds. When he went out into it, his eyes creased at the corners, glistened under the dust in his lashes. He had believed his whole life that luck was just such a light, and like any light, must be accompanied by darkness, and he had learned to seek out such darknesses wheresoever they lay. Though inclined to starched collars and tailored suits by nature, he was no stranger to the grime of the road, and knew the diamond fields in Kimberley had drawn the dregs of the world like soap scum sucked down a drain. Still, he was surprised by the feel of that African boomtown, how much it reminded him of the borderlands in the United States after the war. He stood on its depot platform watching the hopefuls arrive, their shoes and pans gleaming. He peered over the edge of the great open mine into the emptiness. He walked the main street in the dust and heat, astonished by the crowds. There were rabbis with their long beards carrying pans and bedrolls on their backs, and revolutionaries from Poland, and Russians with shovels gripped wrongly in their soft white hands, as if they were clutching leaflets or bombs. He saw ex-convicts from the Australias with tattoos on their knuckles and nary a tooth in their heads, and he saw veterans of the Crimea with arms missing, or loping along on crutches, with a fold of trousers pinned up where a leg should have been. He saw bandits out of the eastern Baltics, with colourful baggy clothes and pistols over their shoulders, and he saw women in varied states of undress, draped over the upper railings of rickety wooden saloons. Every man went armed, even the street preachers, staggering drunkenly on their crates and hollering at the crowds with their fists upturned. What he did not see was the law. He waited. He listened. It seemed the diamonds were not transported on the new railway, but rather trucked out from De Beers and from the other mines surrounding Kimberley,